and the physical length of the element will essentially tell you exactly what frequency it's on. Back to you, Glenn. K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
It sounds like more worth than just a little curiosity. Do appreciate the help, though. Thanks, guys. Take care. N2 Zetical Alpha.
K1FC.
Yeah, when you find out some more about that, let us know, Glenn. K1FC. Fred, bet you know something about this. And you just mailed me an email tonight that I didn't have a chance to check yet. You got it, Fred.
Yeah, don't bother the first one. There was a extraneous V, so it wouldn't open up. This is the second one that's correct. No, I just looked it up online, and there's a website from Carrollton, Texas, that goes into all sorts of things, and they claim to be among the first to have some of these systems. And they say their Yagi antennas for an advanced traffic management center system. Yeah, for their advanced traffic management center that uses spread spectrum technology to, and they claim they're the first wireless traffic signal system in the world. They even have a phone number if you want to go down to Carrollton, Texas and get a tour of all of the things that they have. But they have a few other things like a white light on a pole so that a cop could be parked a block away and tell when you ran a red light by the white light that he sees. So anyhow, that's all I have to add. Thank you, Dick.
Very fine. That's good to know, Fred. So Carlton, Texas is the company that makes this advanced traffic control center thing. Cute. And, the fact that they're using spread spectrum, in other words, it's a frequency hopping scheme, quite possibly it's on the ISM band of 902 to 928 megacycles, and you're allowed to use license-free equipment between 902 and 928 megacycles as long as you hop frequency every approximately 1 millisecond, or is it a fraction of a second, but you have to continuously be hopping on the approximately 50 channels between 902 and 928 and keep the power output under 1 watt and the antenna gain under 6 dB. So if the antenna gain is less than 6 dB and the power output of the transmitter is less than 1 watt, no license is required on the transmitters that do this frequency hopping on the so-called ISM band from 902 to 928, license-free. And maybe that's what that system is using. That would make life a lot simpler. And that gives you all kinds of ideas for setting up things. Many of the domestic radio frequency identification RFID readers are doing exactly that on the 915 meg band, as we call it. Can we drop? I think we've answered all of the questions of the people who signed in. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, and I guarantee Mel's going to like that, because he can get to his youngsters before they have to go to sleep. K2KEY, what's in your mailbag this week, Mel? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, let's see. All right, here's one that many people have asked me, but I don't really know the answer to this. If you notice that the last couple of weeks with the situation in Japan, and these plants that are on the verge of possibly a meltdown, that they were showing that they are measuring the exposure of people coming out of that area with a detector, but it's measuring it in, I believe it's sieverts, millisieverts. And the question is, what happened to Rentgen? We always remember Geiger counters and the Rentgen scale, Dick. Do you have any idea what this new scale is of sieverts? Over.
WS2N. WS2N. I bet you he knows something about that. Go ahead, Paul.
SI units. International system or international standard, whatever it was. SI, they call it. Part of that group. So that's a relatively new one that they use. It's a 100 to 1 ratio to the REM. Now, that's what that is.
So I forget which way it is. I think 1 sievert is equal to 0.001 or 0.01. I forgot the which one is higher or lower, but it's a 100-to-1 ratio. Dick?
I am guessing that if we Google the word sievert and Wikipedia, you're going to get a very nice answer. REM is the system of units that used to be used. REM stands for Rankin Equivalent Man. And in the old days, 450 REM, I believe, was considered MLD 5030. That meant if a whole body exposure of 450 REM took place in the old days, 50% of the population who got that exposure would die within 30 days. That's what the MLD stands for, minimum lethal dose, 50% of the population, and 30-day period for passing on. 450 REM was the approximate number that was considered lethal. In the case of sieverts, I was told that not only is it a slight change of units, but also it is spectrum-related. In other words, certain kinds of radiation, alpha, beta, gamma, are more absorptive and more lethal to a human being than others. So I think the sievert system not only measures the magnitude, but takes the individual kinds of radiation, you could call it wavelengths if you like, and adjusts them by a correction factor which really represents the lethality, so that the same number of sieverts of alpha radiation, the same number of sieverts of beta radiation, maybe has the same amount of lethality. That's a guess on my part. But we're going to have to do a little bit more research on this one. I wonder if anyone else on frequency has got a little bit more nuclear knowledge and can tell us what the sievert really means. If so, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K1FC.
Go right ahead, Fred. And Fred, wait for the beeps, otherwise you might not be resetting the machine and you might time out. There's about 4 beeps. K1 Friendly Charlie, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay, actually, without getting into the differences on radiation, you may want to open that email that I sent you. It's sort of rather apropos, and it redefines, actually, there were 2 things in there on the conventional sievert scale and different sources, but another way of measurement that I think people can relate to called the BEM, which is the banana equivalent, and it's rather interesting to see since bananas do have a standard dose of potassium 40, which is radioactive, how it stacks up in your exposure to eating bananas, and that's why I sent it to you. K1FC.
Now this reminds me, I know it's a little bit off to one side, but it shows you the degrees of misunderstanding of the word radiation. There are many communities that are giving ham radio operators quite a bit of grief because they want to set up an antenna, and there's an even larger number of communities that are trying to restrict the installation of cell sites because they think the RF radiation is dangerous to human beings. And the problem is primarily one of vocabulary. The fact that radio energy is called RF radiation. If we have been smart enough to call it RF transmission, RF signaling, call it anything else, then people wouldn't be misapplying it to nuclear radiation, which is very different. However, I'm a member of the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network. It consists of 40 very smart people that on average have 30 years of experience in some branch of electronics, computers and antennas and mechanical engineering and civil engineering and chemical engineering and whatever. So 40 very smart people. One of the computer mavens about a year ago asked me this question, and that is, when I take my food out of the microwave oven, how long should I wait for the food, for the radiation to die down? What's the half-life of the radiation of my food in the microwave oven? Wow, let me drop. that represents an extremely strong misunderstanding of what RF energy is. With a smile, I gave him an answer. I said the half-life of the radiation on your food is approximately 40 picoseconds. He looked at me kind of strange. 40 picoseconds is 40 times 10 to the minus 12 seconds. Where did that number come from? The microwave oven runs at 2.45 gigahertz. 1 over 2.45 gigahertz. I rounded it off and said it was 40 picoseconds. In other words, as the last cycle of energy coming out of the magnetron tube, which is transmitting that signal into the microwave oven, as the last cycle out of the magnetron tube dies down, that's the exact rate at which the RF energy in your food dies down. You couldn't possibly get the food out of the oven fast enough, if you know what I mean. There is no storage of RF energy capability in your food, except for the fact that what the microwave oven does. The microwave oven creates heating of the water molecules that are in your food. And yes, the water molecules continue to have their warmth, the temperature that you can measure with a thermometer. So I could talk about the thermal time constant of your food. How soon is your food going to cool off? Thermally, that which you measure with a thermometer as you take it out of the microwave oven, that's the real cool-off time. So lots and lots of misunderstanding of how RF energy works in a microwave oven and what RF radiation really means and what specific absorption rate means when it comes to a cell phone. But we're getting off subject. Let's go back to Mel's mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW.
2EO on this subject.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, you know, a few weeks ago, prior to the Japanese incident, I bought on eBay a radiation detector that it's from the 60s. It's yellow, it's got a civil defense emblem on it, and I think I paid like $15 for it, and it works. Probably the price has gone way up. The reason I originally bought it was because I was concerned that if the terrorists ever set off a dirty bomb in New York City, they might not alert the public how bad it was, but fear of starting a panic. It's got a meter that reads HR/R or R/HR. I know that's... Is that Rankins per hour? Is that rads per hour? And could you give me just a basic explanation of the difference between rads, Rankins, and curies?
Right now, Rich, I do not know. I think I have it one time in the past, read up on this. Right now, I don't know. But I am more than curious. I mean, we're now getting... lots and lots of news about what's going on in Japan. We're going to be hearing about that for months to come. That's not going to go away overnight. So it's time that we all educate ourselves in this subject. And by Googling those words in Wikipedia, I know we're going to get 90% of what we want to know. So I don't know. I wonder if anyone listening here wants to throw in a couple of words as to what they know about the radiation terms. Give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, QIQ.
There's a guy who knows. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've got all the answers for Rich there, but those old meters were rems per hour. That was the basically the unit that they kind of like averaged how that meter would read. And Rich, let's put it this way: if one of those old meters is giving you a measurement, get out of that area soon, because I think the acceptable levels for REMS today, what they say as far as exposure is much, much less than what that meter reads. So if that meter is reading something, that's an area you don't want to be in. I think also today they have patches and other disposable type devices that measure the ionized radiation over time. And as those things change color, that's actually a better way of doing it, telling you that you've got too much exposure. Because you know, the whole thing with radiation exposure is not only just the level of the radiation, but how long you're in it. The type of it's like the same thing with X-rays and other things. When you go to a doctor's office, you're only allowed so many for a certain period of time before it can really affect your health. And I think the discussion before, I did look up sieverts versus REMs, and one sievert is equal to 100 REMs, but the rest of the conversions, I'm not sure of, Dick. Let me pitch back to you. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Comment, Dick?
And KC2YDT, what's the comment?
Okay, John and Matt, in that order. So, one sievert is 100 REMs. Sievert is a bigger unit. Wow. I can see why we're going to be measuring things in millisieverts and microsieverts. And that older unit you've got there, Rich, is probably a Geiger-Mullen tube, which by modern standards was very insensitive. It's like Glenn was saying, if that reads anything significant, you better be moving in the other direction pretty fast. Whereas the modern-day scintillation counters are a hell of a lot more sensitive. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, I was just going to say to Rich, if it has a cord with an extended arm where he has a Geiger-Müller tube in it, that unit may be working properly. They were pretty good. They were made by Victorine. But they also made the scintillation disc type, and that's from the 60s or early late 50s, and those scintillation discs deteriorate. So if he doesn't have the test piece with it, which they usually don't give you, I wouldn't trust that unit.
Yeah, pretty good to know, John. Go ahead, Matt.
KC2YDT. I also wanted to touch a little bit of what Len was saying. But we use in the city a lot. We have portable radiation detectors, you know, almost the size of a beeper. You know, they're put on our belt. Also on the ambulance, and they are set for whatever the acceptable level of radiation is. And then anything past that will get a meter reading of how much it is. If you want more information on that, you can look at HomelandSecurityToday.com. That's HomelandSecurityToday.com. And they have anything you could possibly want about radiation.
That's very good to know, Matt. Thank you for the information. HomelandSecurityToday.com. It's going to give us a lot more info on the subject. Okay. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I happen to own one of those old counters that were from this civil defense day, and they were painted yellow, and had the tube in this extended cable, you know, this type of spring-like cable, hold the unit in one hand, pull the trigger, and then, you know, move around whatever was the check for radiation. That whole thing with that civil defense base, you know, was a bunch of real baloney because, you know, that, if you remember the take cover, you know, a hydrogen bomb is going off in the city and you ran in, the kids would have to go under the desk in the classroom, Dick, that was your protection against a hydrogen bomb, if you remember that, over.
It's called duck and cover.
It's better than nothing, but it's not a hell of a lot. Why don't you go to your next email, Mel?
Whiskey, Alpha.
Okay, here we go. I'm just reading them over, that's why. I know I have lots of filter through here. All right, here's one that I think we sort of covered the distances. In the past, I think we've heard something similar a lot. It makes the thermostat, causes problems with the thermostat. What do you suggest doing? Or what? I understand there are cores and beads. Which ones do you suggest put on the wire, or how to do it? Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, the thermostat in my house is probably very similar to many houses, and that is It's got a great big long wire that goes all the way down to the basement and closes a set of contacts at the furnace to turn it on. So that's an extremely long antenna. And somewhere in the house there is a something like a 12-volt transformer, the equivalent of a wall wart, which is feeding the whole system. So all of that wiring can become an antenna. These clip-on ferrite devices you can buy from Radio Shack are likely to give you a lot of benefit. In other words, you clip that onto the wiring right at the electronic control of the thermostat itself. And I think that can avoid a lot of the RF energy being picked up by that long wire and transmitted back to that electronics. If that doesn't do it, and if then you go the next step and buy a toroid ferrite, toroid thing, and take the wiring and wrap it a few turns through the toroid, which gives you even more inductance. If that doesn't do it, then you've got to either move the antenna further away from the house on a longer transmission line, make sure your transmission line is not hot, and by the way, if you're not using a balun, let me drop. If you've got a dipole-like antenna on 80 and 40 meters, and you've done the simple thing of just bringing the coax cable up to the dipole and take the center conductor and connect it to the right-hand side of the dipole and connect the shield of your coax cable and connect it to the left side of your dipole, and you've done nothing else. In other words, you haven't used a baluning device at that point. You didn't put a few turns of the coax cable as a loop held together with tape or tie wraps. If you haven't done anything to control the so-called common mode, then by definition you have a significant amount of RF energy flowing down the outside of that transmission line once it's connected to that antenna and you're transmitting into that antenna. And as such, that transmission line coming into the shack and maybe going somewhere near the wiring of the thermostat is aggravating the problem. So putting in the right kind of a choking device at the antenna, the right kind of a baluning device, putting choking devices on the wire of the thermostat, and then moving the antenna itself physically further away. These are the best defenses I can think of, other than changing brand name of your thermostat. Anyone else who's had thermostat radio frequency interference problems, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the DECnet. It looks like we haven't got any further information on it. Those are the best suggestions I can think of, Mel. And for the guys in the Kings County Radio Club, what have they done, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I'll tell you what, I've done some experimenting in this, and I did find something that seems to work really positive. I found that cores, toroidal cores with a number 43 mix. You know, they come by different mix. Their size, they give you size, and then there's the mix number. If you get 43 mix, it's a good round material for, especially it seems like, for 160 and 80 and 40 meters. Low frequency HF. And another thing that I found works also, along with this, you can try putting 0.01 capacitors across the wires going to the thermostat, especially if it's a two-wire system. Try putting the capacitors across the two wires first. You could also try attaching the capacitors from each wire to the ground or the case. You'll notice a lot of thermostats, of course, are in what we call gem boxes, metal boxes that they put in the wall. And you can take each wire, from each wire, put a 0.01 to that box. Many times that helps, but that 43 mix seems to really do wonders. You can wrap several turns of the thermostat wire through that stick over.
And where's the easiest place I can buy toroids with number 43 mix? I'm a little worried that that might not be in the bubble packs at Radio Shack. Where would you go to buy those, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not going to find that so quick. It's funny. I bought quite a bit of different toroids. I bought basically saying I'm always making some kind of a, winding some kind of a device using, you know, toroids. Of course, I grew up in the day we did it with, on plug tune coils, of course, and IF cans and things, of course, which have sort of come somewhat passe. So I went and bought a lot of toroids. Originally, I bought this Amazon Makes a Kit with an assortment of all kinds. And it was really fascinating to play around with all different mixes. And so if you want a particular, like a 43 mix, depending on the size you want, you get from Amazon, you get their catalog. They're very nice. Small sales are no problem. And there you are. Many ham fests. I was just going to say at many ham, one in a ham fest. I think it was the Limark. The guy had a whole slew of them in laying out, and I think half a dozen to a bag for like a dollar a piece, Dick, over.
2 Eotas.
Hey, Whiskey Alpha. Okay, I heard a Whiskey Alpha, but Rich first. N2EO, go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, Amidon is in Hollywood, California, so Amidon. Another company is Palomar. I think it's Palomar, Palomar Electronics in California, either one, Amidon or Palomar. And something I once brought up on the net about this, on this net, and I'll bring it up again, I had severe telephone RFI, and what I found enhances this. You want the core you want, Mel is right, you want a 43 mix. The particular core is called an FT240-43. That means ferrite toroid, 2.4 inch, 43 mix. Let me let it drop. And something you can do that will really enhance it, you take that 2.4 inch donut and you hold, say, the best way to describe it is you hold it vertically so you can picture a clock. You start off, say, 12 o'clock straight up, and you wind clockwise from 12 o'clock down to 6 o'clock. Then you go up, back up to 12 o'clock, and you wind down the other side counterclockwise from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock. What that does is cancel out capacitance in the between the turns, and you really get a lot of inductance. It works great. Go ahead, Dick.
Good to know. Thank you, Rich. FT240-43, toroid by Amidon of Palomar. Whiskey Alpha. And I think there's a lot more to the call letters. Give me your full call. Give me your name. And then go right ahead with your comments, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Wait for the beep. Okay, Mel, why don't you go to your next mailbag question. K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I was just going to add, you know, for somebody like Palomar and places like that to pick up ferrite cores and things, they're kind of like generically okay, but if somebody wanted to do a little bit more advanced search in, you know, magnetic materials, two very, very good suppliers, you can look them up on the internet, is Arnold Magnetics, and the other one is called Magnetics Inc. And they have online catalogs for virtually any kind of ferrite, mixes that you'd like, and also you can get the mixes like moly permalloys with the nickel inside of them. You can get the powdered iron cores. So in other words, you can get a whole bunch of different types of toroids, e-cores, anything you want, and all different geometries. So if somebody wants to do something a little bit more advanced, Arnold and Magnetic Sync are probably two very good sources. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Good to know, Glenn. By the way, Glenn, that carryover from last week, I did a little bit more research into the size of nuclear power stations. Many of them are 600 megawatts. Many of them are 800 megawatts. The Shoreham nuclear station started off as 600, and it went up to 820 was the final design, which did get completed but didn't get a chance to be turned on. You were coming up with numbers of hundreds of gigawatts. None of them go that big. The high number of hundreds of megawatts are the popular sizes, and about the biggest ones you'll find are 1.2 and 1.2 gigawatts. But around 800 megawatts is probably an average size, good size nuclear power station, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, but Dick, isn't that the size of just one reactor? In other words, I think many of these nuclear power plants are up to more than one reactor. In other words, like that one over in Japan, that one alone was, I think, six reactors with similar capabilities, as you just mentioned.
Yeah, well, when it comes to the amount of risk you're going through, it's a function of what is the size of each individual reactor. And hopefully they're spaced far enough apart that a failure of one does not affect the failure of another. Although, as according to 60 Minutes tonight, we heard a report from an American expert that's really worried about that. The fact that the Japanese power stations are so closely mounted to each other. They're on a fault line, and they're in an area of a high probability of a significant tsunami. So not so good a combination. So they are worried about the fact that the failure of one could aggravate the failure of another nearby. But the individual stations, individual reactors, rarely exceed a gigawatt. They're the high number of hundreds of megawatts. If you go beyond that, your ability to uniformly cool that core during a shutdown operation becomes more and more questionable. And that's the problem they're having right now, that the lack of local power does not allow them to run pumps, which pump in the water, which has to cool things down. Even though the moderator rods have been plugged back in immediately at the beginning of the seismic event, and that shuts down the new nuclear reaction, but the previous nuclear reaction created a whole lot of side products that you have to wait until they cool down, and I'm speaking radioactive-wise as well as thermally. So a significant amount of cooling fluid is required for a significant number of hours and days beyond the time you close down a nuclear reactor. Let me drop. And my understanding is that this problem of cool down time becomes aggravated the higher the percentage of the running you were doing. In other words, if you were running the machine at a 20% power level, your cool down time is much, much shorter than if you were running it at 95% capability. Unfortunately, you get the best amount of economics out of the nuclear power station if you run it at the highest probability, which means you're running it at the highest risk, the highest capability. If you're running it at the 95% level, you better have cooling capability for, let me pick a number, a good fraction of a week. And that didn't exist. And as such, because of the lack of power required to continuously pour in the cooling fluids, which are being boiled away. So they're not out of the woods yet. Why don't you go to one more of your email requests, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Dick, could I just add one more comment to this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just this whole situation with me is a very, very heavy heart. And I, for some reason, going back, I guess, to the 70s when, you know, we had, you know, problems with, you know, a big fight with all of this going on here in Long Island with the Sherman facility. You know, at that time, I thought nuclear was possibly a good alternative. And I guess just over the years and more I learned about it, that, like you're saying, that in order to really put the safety into these things, you have to overbuild them so much to the point that you can no longer make cost-effective electricity. So it leaves you with this situation that, you know, there's always this possibility of these kinds of disasters. And I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to me, the moving forward with nuclear energy with in these locations. Plus, we have these other plants that are getting older, and you have the shell game with the fuel. And what do I mean by shell game? Well, what happens is, okay, you take nuclear fuel, you use it in there, the rods get used up. Then what do you do with the rods? Those rods can't just go anywhere. I mean, what they're doing now is they bring them to some place and they bury them in the sand in a location that you can't go near for like 100 years. So, you know, it's just putting one disastrous thing from one location to another disastrous location. To me, that just doesn't sound like a good idea. Just an opinion, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, Eric recognized the total cool-down time of those rods is very significant. You take the rods you've used for a couple of years in your reactor. You then put them into a cooling pool nearby, and you keep them covered with water for a couple of years before they cool down enough radioactive-wise as well as thermally that you can now safely ship them to a place where they get reprocessed for a more permanent storage. That total fuel cycle is very expensive. The good news is it gives you independence from the Arab oil. The bad news is that the total fuel cycle is not cheap. And people like Eric and I are quite much more in favor of the renewable energy types like wind and solar and tide. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I just want to point out two things. The maximum output of the SHRM was 806 megawatts from what I've read. And that's the total output of all the reactors. One thing that we forget is that we use the nuclear reaction to create steam, which runs turbines, which runs generators through a heat exchanger. The other thing is that even when you put the when you put your spent rods into the pool, not only we talk about cool, the reason why we put them in water is not so much for cooling as it is for reducing the velocity of free neutrons that are running. So you can have stable rods in a cooling pool, and then when you lose the water, you start to get a reaction again because the neutrons are shooting at each other and raising the temperature of those particular rods. So that's why in Japan, in the reactor number 4 building, they have the problem of the rods not being covered with water, meaning it's getting hot. K2RIW, K2J.
LNFC.
Yeah, Fred recognized. We'll go to you in a second, Fred. When it comes to the water, you made it sound like the water is an extremely good moderator. Describe to me, Eric, your understanding of the usual carbon rods as moderator versus water moderator for the so-called cooling pool. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, if you've ever taken a trip through Brookhaven when they had their stuff going, the distance between the rods and the cooling pool are much farther apart than they are in the core of the reactor. The cesium rods were, or the moderator rods, the second the earthquake hit, you know, they were in place. So they're absorbing a lot of the fission reaction that's going on. But in free space, that's why if you've ever seen the vehicles that they use to truck them, each individual rod has a tremendous amount of lead surrounding it, and they don't allow the neutrons to pass and hit another rod. So water is a somewhat of a moderator of alpha and beta particles, which helps to slow things down. And it's also the main cooling device. But it actually does offer a little bit of resistance. That's why they're so, the space as far apart as they are, and the water beyond cooling also offers a little bit of dampening.
When I was out at Brookhaven Lab during one of their open houses, and I was in the nuclear reactor building, and there was a pool of water alongside of the reactor where previous rods had been removed, and those rods were now in the bottom of that pool of water. And that water looked like it was, I'll pick a number, 20 feet below me, the top of those rods. And as I looked down into that pool at those rods, I saw an extremely significant blue glow of all of the water around those rods. I am guessing I'm seeing the neutrons coming out of those rods, striking the water molecules and creating something like Cherenkov radiation, and that's the blue glow I am seeing. That's a guess on my part, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, that's a good guess, because I believe, I could be wrong, I believe what happens is the neutrons are banging into the water molecules, they're knocking the oxygen off, you're getting free oxygen molecules that are being excited, and that's why it's blue in color.
Let's see what Fred's got to say about all this. K1FC, wait for all four beeps, and then talk to us, Fred. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, actually, what I was going to chime in on was an approach to nuclear power. There's actually several, and the government is working on building one, a higher efficiency, but it's still solid uranium. But there have been several articles last year, the July-August issue of American Scientist, which is a publication of Sigma Xi. It was a very good article on using thorium as your fuel. The advantages of thorium is that you get a tiny fraction of the waste. Like your actinides are reduced by a factor of 10,000 to 1. The volume of spent fuel afterwards is much smaller. The yield, by the way, of the solid uranium rods, you only have 4% conversion before the transformation of the various elements causes swelling and the rods become a problem. One of the limitations on solid rods is generation of things like xenon-135, which if you try to get your action going too fast, becomes a limiting thing. You're limited by the rate that the xenon-135 breaks down, it decays. So anyhow, you might want to look up, unfortunately, the American Scientist article. You have to pay if you, it's online, but you have to pay if you're not a member. But there are some other things, and you might find it interesting to look into what advantages there are in terms of using thorium instead of uranium. The only drawback to thorium is you don't get any plutonium to make bombs. And that was...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If thorium is such a desirable fuel to use with a nuclear reactor, Fred, where does the thorium come from? Is that a more expensive fuel? And is it just a later design that hadn't been devised at an earlier time? How come we're not using thorium right now? K1FC, wait for the beeps, all four, K2RIW.
Thorium is four times more abundant than uranium. However, by itself, you have to expose it to a neutron source such as U-233, U-235, or plutonium. The most recommendations are because it generates U-233 and U-232 that you start off with U-233 as your seed for the thorium. It is more abundant. It is found wherever in areas where you mine other rare earth metals. It is more, as I say, it is a lot more abundant. And reactors have been built using thorium. So there have been experiments done, but the reason for the solid uranium, one was apparently Rickover's choice of the solid uranium for the Nautilus submarine became a major factor in the development of the current nuclear reactors. And also, with thorium, you don't get any plutonium, or negligible, actually, you get a very tiny amount of plutonium. Making bombs out of it becomes a lot more difficult because it's hard to separate the U-233 from the U-232. So those are the reasons. But the proposal now to use liquid, one of them is what's called a LFTR, LFTR, the liquid fluoride thorium reactor. Since everything is a liquid, gas generation that becomes not a problem because that can be removed, and you can continuously remove the byproducts, so you don't have anywhere near the reprocessor. The French, by the way, just reprocess the
repeater. Time out. Repeater, timeout.
I wonder if you could give us a couple of words, Fred. You seem to be quite well informed on nuclear systems, of why the Japanese system was using, I think it was plutonium oxide mixed with the uranium in their particular fuel rods, and worry about the fact the machine will time you out in 1.5 minutes. You're out even sooner. K1FC, K2RIW.
Okay, I thought I had 2 or 3 minutes. I'm sorry about that. I don't know why they, you know, they're all based on the plutonium, of course, having the plutonium, if it's available, you have to use either 235 or plutonium to be your main source of neutrons. Well, as I say, you could use 233, but the recommendation is to use 233 with thorium. And there are some tricks, as they say, you'd have to read the article to understand. You want to get just the right neutron flux if it's too high. In other words, for each disintegration, you want 1.08 effective neutrons. If it's more than that, things can run away. But the one thing about thorium reactors is that they are self-limiting. There are other reactor types using uranium that are self-limiting. The high-temperature gas reactor is one of them. And some of the advantages of not having liquid water is that you don't have to deal with the pressures inside the reactor. That's another factor. Thank you.
I'm going to pass it over to Eric if he's available. Maybe he's got some comments on the subject of plutonium oxide mixed with the fuel. And one very simple question I've got, which I don't understand, is why is U-235 used, and what's wrong with U-238? How come we can't use U-238 in either a thermonuclear device or in a nuclear power station? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N.
Alright, K2EJ, we'll give it to F2N in a second. The thing that I remember about MOX or metal oxide mixture is that they use the plutonium that comes from the spent fuel. I think it's 239, and then they can use a low yield uranium or depleted uranium. And I believe they use them in most light water reactors. But I think they've been remanufacturing it to be used in the big reactors that they're using now. Although the one thing that I remember about it that's really bad is that it makes bad disposal problems, because now you're talking about transmutation of the plutonium, which makes them even more have. Their half-life is, I think, 1,400 years or something like that. That's one issue. I'm going to let it drop. And as far as going from 235 instead of 238, I think 238... I could be wrong about this. The decay of 238 is slower. Whereas I remember, like, 238 you can use for thermal generators. Bimetal generators. Because the decay is a lot slower and the output is a lot lower. So, you know, you can call that atomic batteries.
And WS2N.
KC2QIQ.
Paul and Glenn in that order. WS2N, Paul, go ahead.
The odd numbers can only really be used. That's why they use the 235. There's other numbers, there's a whole series of numbers. And 238 is an even number. It has to do with the the physicists behind whoever came up with that unit. There must be a reason why the odd numbers only work properly and not the even numbers. I wanted to comment on Sieverts as well, that was going back before. That was named after a Swedish physicist. I did go to Wikipedia. You get a good breakdown on that. Just like the one fellow was talking about, they even start off with the one banana at 1/10,000th of a millisievert, and then a couple of the other ones. They have the dental. You go to the dentist for an X-ray, and it's 0.005 millisieverts, and they get into chest X-rays, and volunteers, and you know what their limits are for rescuing people. You can go up to 1,000. And then they get into the hourly doses, you know, the how much was being produced at Chernobyl, between 10 and 30,000 millisieverts, big numbers. Nuclear power stations living near 1.01 per year. I'd live next to one, no problem. They have cosmic radiation in the background and, background radiation, all that stuff, Dick. So, like you said, Wikipedia is good. Back to you. WSL.
Thank you, Paul. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, Dick, as far as the atomic numbers go, I believe my understanding is that as the atomic numbers are stepping up, the energy level is going up. So in other words, if you look at the energy level of, let's say, 235 as opposed to 238 going up, 239, the energy output of that's going up exponentially as the as the atomic numbers moving up. I think there's also a big difference between what the Japanese are using as their fuel as opposed to what we're using for fuel here in the United States. The isotope that we're using here in the U.S. I think is lower. The waste fuel, much more. You know, it's the higher the isotope number goes, the waste product is much harder to deal with. So. Those are, you know, some of the answers to what you're saying, but I certainly don't know them all. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If 238 has more energy than 235, I'm going to guess that the neutrons come flying out of 238 at a much higher energy level, velocity, call it what you like. Therefore, when they hit the next uranium atom, they might not dwell long enough to be captured, therefore not sustain a chain reaction. That's a guess on my part. I know that they do not use 238 per se in a bomb. They use 235. So even though the energy may be greater, it may not be in a useful form. Is that possible, Glenn? Go ahead.
Dick?
Go ahead, Eric.
You know, I remember 238 is what we consider to be natural uranium. And it's, from what I remember, it's a fertile material. It's not a fissile material. So, and what you're saying, I think, is about right, because it's a material that can capture slow neutrons. So that's probably why 235 is fissile.
KC2QIQ.
You got it, Glenn. Thank you, Eric. Glenn, you got it.
Well, keep in mind the applications here, too. One is a slow burn, where you want to have a medium temperature transferred to, you know, from a core to water and create steam. The other one, you want to create a bang, an impulse of energy. So they're really two different applications. In one application, you want to have a fuse and to be able to ignite an impulse of energy. The other one, you want to have slow burn. So it's not a very simple answer that I can give you with that. But basically, that's really what the difference is in the two different forms of reaction. In other words, you want to set up your materials in a way with a fuse and create an impulse in one, and in the other one, you want to create slow burn. So two different characteristics, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You know, when I get in front of a computer in about 20 minutes, I'll look it up and I'll give you the real answer.
We're all going to get smarter. We're not going to be nuclear engineers, but we're going to get a little smarter. We're walking each other way through. And at the atomic level, we're slowly getting smarter, too. We're babes in the woods in all these areas. Okay, let's see what the latest is going on with John and Wesley. KC2WGB first. John, What's the experiment of the day, John? K2RIW in the TechNet?
KC2WGV. Well, Dick, my experiment was that diplexer. That's about all I got done this week. I was fooling with that. But I believe the original plutonium bomb was 239, Fat Man. I don't think it was 235. I don't know what they're using now. That was the compressive bomb, as opposed to the cannon bomb, which was the simple U-235 bomb, which was a little boy, I think. But you can ask Wesley for his questions, because I've got mine for the day. Back to you, Dick.
Wesley, I got a chance to see some, not all, of the emails you mailed me. One of them was the Rogers technique, by which low-frequency energy is transmitted through the Earth, and apparently at very long distances. Mr. Rogers has a whole bunch of patents that he formed way back in 1919, in which he was sending signals from Earth to Earth and Earth to submarine and so on. Looks like fascinating stuff. Into XJN, K2RIW, and try to ask us one question at a time, Wesley. Sometimes you combine three or four questions, and I get a little bit confused. You got it, Wesley.
Into XJN. Yes, thank you for reminding me that. I'm trying to improve myself in this area. In the search of a series of the experiments that I have made, I was looking at the different areas for the low frequency oscillation. And then I got into something that when I was young, I was just a boy, 15 years old boy. There was an author of the ham radio book that was modern electronic at that time, and he made the article in this book. There was the first edition of the book, which was using Earth for the communication. And he described that. I was young at that time. The next edition of that was stripped from the chapter. And of course, nobody asked the question at that time. There was a communist regime. But what's happening now, we have year 2011, and most of the information are not accessible. There are only few. There is no great amount of people dealing with that. The Earth communication is being used by submarine, but the inventor of that communication was Mr. Roger in 1918. And the first experiments were provided in 1880. So, quite a long time ago. Let me drop. The radio amateurs and electronics hobbies have used this mode for limited range communication using audio power amplifiers connected to widely spaced electrode pairs hammered into the soil. And at the receiving end, the signal was detected as a weak electric current between two further pairs of electrodes. So in other words, you have two electrodes within the distance from 10 to 50 meters, 150 feet. But it could be 10 meters, so it's 30 feet. You connect the amplifier into that, and it is possible to receive signals at range of a few kilometers, which would be a few miles as well, with the transmitting power from 10 watts to 100 watts. Now, what Mr. Roger did, let me jump. He was able to send the signals he was able to be heard very far away with his antennas. And also, Mr. Rogers' inventions was allowing to receive the signals from the power station in Honolulu. I wonder if you have any more information.